From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Eric, Mark, welcome back. Pleasure as always.
The pleasure is all mine.
Thanks for having me back. CPR.
Okay, so I think we're going to talk about Syria this week because there's just so much going on and so much that's come out, too. I think it's Mark's turn to go first this week.
Yes, right. His chair was empty last week, so let him begin.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, do you want to phrase me with a question, or do you just want me to go off the cuff?
Well, the thing, just let's talk about what's been in the news. Some of the disclosures, the replenishing of armaments by the U.S. after the Russian Air Force destroys them. Thing, you know, start maybe in that area.
Yeah, I guess we've seen continuing Russian airstrikes. I think in the midweek they actually upped the tempo of airstrikes to very close to 90 airstrikes a day. Now, this is significant from a military perspective because with the number of aircraft, 32, that they have capable of doing airstrikes in the country, this is very near theoretical maximum of what is possible. And that indicates that the Russian military is operating at a level of modernization and efficiency that U.S. military planners are just leaves their mouth gaping because they didn't expect that Russia is really capable of this. Now, the question remains how long they can keep up the pace, but the fact that they can achieve it alone with a relatively modest, small expeditionary force is very much impressing the brass in the Pentagon.
What does it say also about the infrastructure that remains in Syria? Because they've got to fuel those planes. They need airstrips. All of that stuff. And after 4.5 years of war, they can still operate from that territory. This is
the thing from everything that we have read from the Russian operation there. Everything is being provided by Moscow. Everything is being flowed in, from food to fuel to everything. Everything is being supplied by Russia, not by the Syrian government. So that, again, is a logistics chain, being supplied by air through the Dardanelles, the combination of the two of them. Very efficiently for such a long distance. I certainly didn't think they would be capable of it. Right now, they've slowed the tempo down a little bit towards the end of the week as they're concentrating on close air support for what is a series of offensive coming from the Syrian Arab Army, the National Defense Forces of Syria, Hezbollah, and Iranian and Afghani troops that are now going on the offensive against the various jihadist groups in the country, most particularly in some places, yes, ISIS, but also the Islamic Army of Conquest, in particular, Ahrar al-Sham, the largest group of the Islamic Army of Conquest, and Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria. Now, this presents a big problem for the Americans because a number of what they call American-backed rebels, okay, these are some brigades that generally have some loose affiliation with the so-called Free Syrian Army, this branding image, but more importantly, are fighting alongside and apparently under the operational command, according to the New York Times and the Washington Post, of al-Qaeda. That's right, U.S.-backed rebels fighting under al-Qaeda in Syria. And it's just flabbergasting to me that the American press is not drawing this more to the attention of the American people rather than hiding it in one or two vaguely worded sentences in their articles. President Obama should frankly have to get come to the families of the victims of 9/11, get down on his hands and knees, and explain to them why their tax dollars today are going to pay the training, the arms, and the salaries of Islamists, jihadists, rebels, whatever you want to call it, who are fighting under the Al-Qaeda military operations command in Syria. This is just insane. We were living in a very, very surreal place. Obama, the deep state's obsession with regime change in Syria has led America into a very, very dark place where we now see Al-Qaeda openly as our allies.
Let me go back a few years to what the standard was. There is standing legislation in the United States that makes it a crime to offer material support to terrorist groups and specifies among those Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra. Lynn Stewart spent 4.5 years in prison for issuing a press conference for someone who was a client who was in prison that was interpreted as possibly signaling maybe to some people in Egypt not to go along with a peace accord. She spent 4.5 years for that. The United States is operating to, A, cut off the supply chain for Russia to its own forces fighting Al-Qaeda. That, you know, they're going to every country they can and saying, don't let them overfly. And, you know, they've had successes with that. And they're dropping weapons and doing what you just described, Mark. Eric, what do you think of that?
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple of points there. I think obviously it almost goes without saying that the laws don't really apply to the U.S. government. That's for the peons who have to follow the laws, while the U.S. government and the military are really above the laws. And of course, perhaps the most obvious example would be international law, which the U.S. and the U.S. military flouts on a pretty much everyday basis. Almost every aspect of U.S. foreign policy is in violation of some or other international law. And certainly the Lynn Stewart example is a good one. And of course, obviously, Lynn Stewart, for those people who don't know, part of the reason why she was targeted was her defense, her spirited defense in court of certain elements who they were trying to pin the 1993 World Trade Center attacks on. And a lot of uncomfortable information about that conspiracy came out in courtrooms. And she is basically the fall person for a lot of that. But I think that we have a couple of interesting things that we really need to point out, and I want to piggyback off of something that Mark was saying, actually a couple of things. First of all, the support that the United States is now providing for these so-called rebels on the ground, I would want to note something interesting that people should have picked up on in the propaganda in the Western media. There was a very interesting, and I've been covering Syria extensively since this war began in 2011, there's a very interesting and very subtle change in the propaganda in the Washington Post and the New York Times and all of the other media mouthpieces that follow their lead. Notice the injection of the word relatively into the phrase moderate rebels. We have heard this phrase moderate rebels over and over, or moderate elements over and over and over again ad nauseum for the last 4 years or so. Moderate rebels, moderate rebels, moderate forces. And now they have this term relatively moderate rebels. Now,
also relatively secular. I saw that.
Relatively secular. This word relatively is very interesting because of the change. And I mean, on the one hand, it's absurd and comical. On the other hand, it's very dangerous because what they're essentially trying to do is not only whitewash terrorism, but they're essentially trying to normalize the U.S. relationship, overt, out in the open relationship with terrorists, with terrorist elements. Now, those of us who are, you know, Syria watchers already knew this and have been talking about it for a long time. But now that they're even publishing it in the mainstream sources, what does this tell us about the shift in U.S. policy? That it's no longer just going to be the CIA working with the Muslim Brotherhood to funnel weapons to terrorists, as the New York Times reported in 2012. It's no longer going to be, you know, singular reports here and there, you know, Reuters and The Guardian and a few others, you know, scattered around and buried on the back pages. This is now out in the open as a cornerstone of U.S. policy. And I think that that is very, very dangerous, as we saw with this airdrop of 50 tons of ammunition. who in the hell was that ammunition for? Because this is a very real question. It's openly admitted that the so-called moderate rebel forces are few and far between, that they represent a tiny minority on the actual battlefield. So 50 tons of ammunition to whom, I would ask? Obviously, I think any reasonable political observer would conclude that that is going to the Islamic State, Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, and these other, you know, maybe the three or four major terrorist factions that are on the ground in Syria right now, A, so that they can prepare themselves for what you already mentioned, this clear offensive, which is coming from the Syrian Arab army, and B, we don't actually, why would we believe what the media is reporting and what the U.S. has basically said, that this is purely ammunition? Who knows that? Nobody knows that. Nobody knows what weapons are in this airdrop. Are there anti-tank weapons, TOWs? Are there anti-aircraft weapons possibly intended to shoot down Russian planes? We have the example of Afghanistan in the 1980s to prove that the U.S. is certainly not above doing something of that magnitude. We don't actually know what's involved in that airdrop, and this is an escalation, clearly and unmistakably an escalation that needs to be pointed out. And again, this relatively moderate term, I think, is very interesting because it signals a policy shift, not only a propaganda and a shift in the lexicon, it signals a policy shift. It seems to me, I guess after I'm done, maybe Mark disagrees, I don't know, but it seems to me that they have now gone along with what David Petraeus presented to the U.S. Congress, namely that al-Qaeda is an ally, that we need to be arming al-Qaeda and we need to be doing it openly and we need to be stepping up that support, because the relatively moderate label seems to me a euphemism for al-Qaeda and for terrorist elements. Now, one other point I wanted to touch on what Mark said about logistics and Russian logistics. It's very true, everything he said in terms of the number of sorties versus the number of actual jets available to run these bombing runs. But I think, and I know that Mark probably agrees with me, but I think that really, ultimately, this is a signal to Washington. It's not just that Washington stands there, their mouths agape, surprised by this. I think it is very clearly intended by Moscow to send a message to Washington, and I think it's not the first time. A, they want to demonstrate what their actual logistical capabilities are, as well as their air capabilities and their ability to coordinate such a small force, but on a large geographical area. And B, I think we see something very similar with the cruise missile strikes from the Caspian Sea. The vessels that are in the Caspian Sea that the Russians have been using to launch these missiles up until now, I think that there were a lot of questions in Washington as to whether or not the Russians were actually capable of doing something like that and doing it effectively. And if we're to believe Russian military reports on the accuracy of these, it is quite frankly about as accurate as what the U.S. has demonstrated its capabilities are in terms of cruise missile strikes from naval vessels. So what this means then is that the gap between U.S. military power and Russian military power has closed significantly, even more perhaps than many people in the Pentagon believed. And I think that that is probably one of the central objectives of Moscow in this entire Syrian operation. Of course, it's to help an ally. Of course, it's to push these terrorists out of Syria to destroy their infrastructure. But it's also to send a clear and unmistakable message to Washington and to China. And I think that China factors into Russia's thinking as well. As China has these conflicts in the South China Sea with U.S. naval vessels and all of these other issues here, I think Russia is signaling to China that in terms of their alliance, China holds up the economic side, Russia holds up the advanced military capability side. And I think that that is probably one of the fundamental changes in global geopolitics and strategy of the last few decades.
Yeah, I'll just jump off there. We have heard from some serious generals and military thinkers on the U.S. On the cruise missile strikes. Not only is there, no doubt that they are the equivalent of U.S. cruise missile strikes that we've seen for the last two decades, but that the generals have admitted that In some ways, these are actually more technologically advanced than many of their own staple models. It's not that Russia
and the
has
Tomahawk,
closed
the, and the Tomahawk, the U.S.
Yeah, Tomahawk. Yeah. It's not that they've closed the gap between military power per se. That's a broad term. And the United States outspends Russia more than 10-1 on its military budget. Not to mention the rest of non-U.S. NATO, which again outspends Russia more than 3-1 on its military. It's a question of military technology and organization, and Russia has done a lot with very little. Now, again, this is only a relatively small force, but it shows what Russia is capable of and where its military modernization program is going. And Russia continues to punch above its weight here in the military realm doing it very demonstrably. Like U.S. military operations for the last 20 years, they are not only demonstrating to their opponents, but they are also testing. They are seeing what works on the battlefield. You'll see the efficient use of a whole lot of tried and true measures, such as the Su-25 and so on. But you will also see the application of new toys, if you will. I don't want to take away from the seriousness or the inevitable loss of innocent life that comes with it here. But these cruise missile strikes, the use of Su-34s and so on, is a testing ground for weapons. And this isn't something that just Russia does. The U.S. does this regularly. That is where Russia is going with the military operation. Not only the actual effect of it and demonstrativeness of it to its opponents or prospective opponents, but also military testing.
Eric,
you mentioned the 50 tons that have been dropped. First part of my adult life I spent in the military as a military man. Does air dropping weapons in crates into a jihadi overrun country sound like a military strategy to you?
I think it sounds like a chaos strategy to you.
We already know that whatever these weapons are dropped, even if they airdrop to a specific group coordinated at a certain time and so on, that Joshua Landis, one of the premier Middle East scholars in the U.S. at the University of Oklahoma, has said that up to 70-80% of all the weapons that the U.S. Has brought into Syria have ended up with either Jabhat al-Nusra or ISIS.
Yes.
And further, the New York and the Washington Post, the New York and the Washington Post have both reported that Jabhat al-Nusra, that is, we should just call it Al-Qaeda is imposing a one-third tariff on all military, all other rebel groups that cross its territory or operate with it on military weapons that have to be transferred to them. So whoever these weapons ended up for, and the U.S. is being very elusive about this, it never says who these moderate rebels are that they're dropping weapons. We've heard some vague mention of Sunni tribes in the north. We know that the Kurds have gotten some weapon, and I think the Kurds are one group that very few of us have any qualms about the U.S. Arming the Kurds, who also cooperate with the government and with Russia. But to who these Sunni rebel groups are who are getting the weapons, we don't really know. And the U.S. refuses to say. The Russian government has requested multiple times, tell us your targeting information on ISIS if you have problems with who we're hitting. No reply from the U.S. The Russian government then replies, okay, if you don't want to tell us where ISIS is, then tell us what not to hit, what you consider assets within the country. Again, no reply from the United States. The U.S. has turned down a delegation led by the Russian Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, to military coordinate actions in Syria. They flat right refused to accept them. And now the latest word out that I just heard this morning is that the U.S. is refusing to cooperate with Russia on the rescue of any potential downed pilots from either side, you know, cooperate with each other to get these pilots back if they happen to go down or be shot down. This is just it's sulking. It's absolute pettiness. We see no strategy, no coherent, sane strategy, certainly coming out of the Obama administration. And now they are both confused internally, and they are confusing all of their allies externally over exactly what they're doing or what they're going to do, how they're to respond to this, and where we go from here. You know, they've not only been left wrong-footed by Russia's actions here, and they shouldn't have been. I mean, Russia and Syria and Iran have a mutual defense pact. I can't believe that this was ignored by the Western governments and by the Western press for so long. But they've also confused their allies, and this is a problem for NATO. This is a problem for U.S. power projection around the world, and it is, of course, a diplomatic coup for the Russian government.
You know, there's something that I also want to talk to. The U.S. has this massive military capability, but. You know, and they've shown that they can destroy a country, but in terms of the at least the stated objectives at the outset of their military operations, they almost never get to that point. We saw an example just the other day. Sophie Shevardnadze interviewed Hamid Karzai, talking about the last 14 years in Afghanistan, for example, and the state of affairs there, actually worse than when they landed in October of 2001. Russia seems to be coordinating its political and military objectives, or at least the stated ones, a hell of a lot better than the United States has. Do you think that's also a message that's being sent? And in terms of the display, you both mentioned China. Do you think this is also an opportunity, like an air show would be, for arms sales by Russian arms manufacturers?
Oh, definitely. I don't know that Russian arms manufacturers are desperately in need of showing their wares. I mean, Russia is by far the second most important player globally in terms of arms sales, just behind the U.S. So, I mean, they already have a significant market share, and certainly they would like to grow that. Obviously, it's billions of dollars, and the advanced technology.
They're producing a capacity right now.
Yeah, the advanced technology. Right. Well, but again, they want to demonstrate their advanced technology, advanced capabilities. We have the reports, I guess, earlier this year that China will be the first recipient of the S-400 missiles. Certainly, there are other countries that are lining up for S-300s beyond just Iran. There's a lot going on, I think, that we're not 100% clear about in terms of Russian arms sales. But I would say that that's probably secondary to the political message that's being sent by Russian military capability. And certainly, as you mentioned, Don, there, China is the major player here because, of course, Russia, in the wake of sanctions and the collapse of global oil prices and other global economic factors, Russia's economy has certainly seen better days. It's probably not collapsed the way that Paul Krugman foolishly predicted and the way that a lot of U.S. media tried to propagandize it. But certainly, it's seen a downturn, and I think that to a large extent, Russia is very much working overtime to try as best it can to alleviate some of that by building up economic capacity with China, and that's a complicated issue that I'm probably not qualified to get into all of the specifics of. But definitely, the military side Russia uses as leverage and as a very nice carrot in terms of persuading China to help them economically to whatever extent that's possible. But again,
Eric, if I could just jump in with one little detail there for a second. India also announced this week that it is finalizing agreements to acquire the S-400 anti-aircraft system.
Yeah, and that's an interest. I didn't know that. That's an interesting development. Although that is a complication as well because of China and India's continued rivalry. And although there is this Shanghai Cooperation Organization to which India wants to be a central player, at the same time, India also has this deep rivalry with China's close ally in Pakistan. I'm sure there are diplomatic and geopolitical considerations to all of this, especially in light of Russia's moves to try to shore up relations with Pakistan in the last year to 18 months. So there's a global political issue at play there, but definitely that is an interesting development to say the least. To coming back to Syria, though, I think that there's a couple of other points that we need to address here. The U.S. policy is not made in the White House typically, and it's not made in the Pentagon. Oftentimes, it is crafted well in advance in the think tanks, in the policy institutes, the Rand Corporation Center for Strategic and International Studies, the Brookings Institution, places like this. And if you follow the literature that these places have put out, particularly on the issue of Syria, the Brookings Institution has been central here. It is actually deeply disturbing, some of what that they have published, including the Deconstructing Syria paper, which demonstrated that U.S. policy and U.S. interests would be to de facto carve up Syria into a collection of mini statelets, which would ultimately, and I think unmistakably, be controlled by the Islamic State, Jabhat al-Nusra, Ahrar al-Sham, some of these other groups. Now, the Brookings Institution won't come out and say that overtly, but that is the implied message here. And I think that part of the U.S. strategy, part of what the U.S. wants to do is publicly posture as if they're supporting so-called moderate or relatively moderate factions, while in fact, I think behind the scenes, understanding clearly that what they're doing to block the consolidation of the Syrian government's power and to block the growing influence of Russia is to create a chaotic quagmire type situation in which the country is not only ungovernable, but is essentially broken apart in much the same way as what they're trying to do in Iraq and what they've been doing in Iraq for a long time. And I think that this is very much part of the strategy. And I don't buy the notion, and I know some people do, and I'm not sure where Mark or Don, where you guys stand on this, but I don't buy the idea that the United States has no idea that this is what's going to happen. I think that there are certain circles, maybe not a consensus, but certain circles in Washington who have long since understood that the Assad government's not going anywhere, that regime change is off the table, and that the best objective, the best outcome for the United States is a breakup of Syria completely and forcing the Russians to take responsibility for it. I think that ultimately they understand that Russian military capability in Syria is going to achieve whatever objectives it sets out for itself. But what they would like to do is to make the country ungovernable and then to force Russia to, in the public arena, be quote unquote responsible for what's happened in Syria, to pin it on Russia. It's a way for the United States to have fomented a war and then shift the responsibility of that war and the consequences of that war onto Russia. And coming back to, Don, what you were alluding to with Hamid Karzai and with Afghanistan, look at what we're seeing in Afghanistan right now. Obama just this week announces that the U.S. will not be withdrawing from Afghanistan. Remember, for the last 7 years, Obama's position, Obama's public persona, his quote-unquote legacy, or the legacy he wanted to build, was that of the man who pulled U.S. troops out of the Middle East, who brought the troops home from Iraq, who brought the troops home from Afghanistan. Well, that is now out the window, and I think that that is precisely as a result result of Russia's influence, growing influence and assertiveness in Syria, and also, and this is an important point as well, China now being the central political and diplomatic player in Afghanistan. China wants Afghanistan to be part of its new Silk Road belt. China wants Afghanistan to be a transit point for a lot of its economic development projects throughout Central Asia. And China, and this is something that is very rarely discussed in Western media, China is the central player in mediation talks between the Taliban and the government in Kabul. China has opened direct relations with Taliban representatives, not those sitting in Qatar, but actually those who are on the ground in Afghanistan. China had a high-ranking Taliban delegation sent to China to have these negotiations and indirectly with the authorities in Kabul. And now you see, because of this growing presence of China, both economically and politically in Afghanistan, no surprise, the U.S. decides to leave its troops in that country. And I don't think that this is purely because of the Islamic State's growing influence there. I don't think this is purely because of, you know, the war crime in Kunduz, the bombing of the hospital, the takeover of Kunduz by the Taliban or any of this. I think that this is precisely to check China's growing presence and influence in Afghanistan. So taken together then, Russia's assertiveness in Syria, China's presence in Afghanistan, you can see what the United States is looking at strategically on the global chessboard here. They're looking at essentially a counterforce against the Brzezinski model, the corridor stretching from North Africa all the way to Central Asia and Western China. They're seeing a penetration of that arc of U.S. hegemony, and now they need a counter move against that. That's what they're doing in Syria. That's what they're doing in Afghanistan.
And Mark and I were talking the other day about another U.S. counter move. If you have perhaps chaos as one potential outcome, another was that Mark suggested, and it resonated when I heard it, the idea of there ending up a statelet controlled by the Sunnis that breaks up the Shia arc through there.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the point. The question would be, what would be the nature of a Sunni statelet? Because you have various competing Sunni groups. There are some Sunni groups allied with the Assad government. There are some Sunni groups who are allied with jihadists. There are some who are maybe somewhere in between. And so even the creation of a Sunni statelet would be in essence at war with itself. And I think we all know what the outcome of that would be. The Islamic State, these extremists would take over it. That would then be the ultimate bulwark against the Shia crescent of dominance from Tehran to Baghdad to Damascus and to Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Obviously, it would be to break that, and it would be to essentially act as a forward operating facility for the Saudis, for the Qataris, and then ultimately for Israelis as well, and then ultimately for the United States. It would be directed against Iran and at the broader level of course, Russia.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, let me start with that statelet that we brought up on your show earlier this week. I think we've already seen plenty, and Eric brings up a very good point. If you really want to understand what the U.S. is up to in Syria and the region as a whole, you have to read Brookings' Deconstructing Syria and their earlier path to Persia, because it really does lay it all out on the table, opening up the drawers, and you can see everything. And they're not shy about it. And if you aren't following the Brookings jihadi fanboy Charles Lister on social media, you should be, because you can see U.S. neocons do an about face and radicalize into jihadist cheerleaders before your very eyes. It's a pretty remarkable and chilling experience just watching them as they continually drool over every rumor of a downed Russian jet or a captured pilot, by their jihadis, by their pet jihadis on the thing. This statelet, Brookings has been talking opening about this for some time now. They see it, they talk very much as a descendant state of ISIS. I think everyone knows at this point, with all the Russian military intervention in Iran and everything, it is simply going to be impossible to roll back all of this territory. The Sunnis have been politically empowered by ISIS. Obviously, not everyone living under ISIS supports it, but obviously a significant percentage of the population there do, having been estranged in terms of political representation, both by the Syrian government in Damascus and by the Shia majority government in Baghdad. So I can't see, I don't think anyone foresees being able to return all of Iraq and Syria under their respective governments' controls. And we're very much looking at an erasure of the Sykes-Picot line there. As to the nature of the regime, obviously no one wants it to be as radical as ISIS is. But there's no question that it will be heavily Salafist and influenced by Saudi Arabia and, of course, through that, the United States. This statelet there, I don't think anyone doubts that it will be in some end result some political compromise that will come out of a stronger negotiating position for the Syrian government that very much what the Russian intervention is doing, giving them a stronger political position for a political settlement, although it remains to be seen with who exactly. This is very ironic because what the U.S. is doing with the creation of a we want to call it a Salafist principality, as the DIA documents does, or a Sunni statelet, it does is it recreates Iraq, the Iraq that existed under Saddam Hussein as a Sunni-dominated state that lies between Iran and Syria. This is a miniature Iraq that's being created out of Western Iraq and Eastern Syria, the Sunni-dominated regions. And it is, as if you will, a correction of the Bush regime change, which was disastrous for U.S. geopolitical influence
but Mark, let's just point out though, it recreates Iraq minus the secularism, minus the state institutions,
minus
the social policies, minus all of the good things about Iraq,
and minus the infrastructure.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for correcting me there, because Iraq was in many ways the same as Gaddafi's government was in Libya, in terms of education, in terms of human development, in terms of order and
secularism and
secularism,
forcefully keeping down Islamist tendencies.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. That it's kind of interesting how secularism has become an enemy of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, whether we're talking Libya, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, Syria. Is it secularism that is the target? Is it pan-Arabism? Is it remnant socialistish states? They're all rolled into one. They all come, from the same source. So that's extremely interesting there. I'm not quite sure I completely buy into this intention of chaos theory for the U.S. military. I think we've touched on this before. I think at some level in the intelligence services, they're very much capable of operating on this level of shall we say, Machiavellianness or cold-bloodedness. But I am deeply convinced that the foreign policy elite of the United States, the State Department, the political parties, very, very much ideologically buy into this idea of democratic the transformative power of Western democracy implanted by military force as a political solution on other countries. They very much ideologically believe that democracy is an absolute good and that it can be transplanted into the Middle East, North Africa context. And this has led to a lot of the chaos that's in the region. Now, whether the U.S. deep state is capable of going along with that with a smile on their face and knowing that the opposite will be the end result of this ideological fantasy that the U.S. continues to make again and again and again, that's another question. But I do believe that the people in the State Department generally are, you know, the definition of madness, of insanity that Einstein. They're making the same ideological mistake again and again and again.
Can I interject on that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, there's something I want to go to that you're at the threshold of, and that is the domestic political considerations here. Because let's say that the deep state had decided that chaos theory those outcomes are just fine. But of course, they can't get domestic political consent for that. And also, you have the European political condition as well. European populist voters also probably would not go along with that. So is it possible that even though there's an acknowledgement across the board, deep state, even in the State Department, wherever in the U.S. government, that the narrative still has to be that, you know, ultimately we're going to have democratic states there? And doesn't that mean that at some point in time there's going to be a political crisis when finally somebody wakes the hell up and says, well, that's not what we're getting?
Yeah, a couple of points I think that have to be made here, and I agree to a point with what Mark's saying, but I would just, I guess, frame it slightly differently. Yes, certainly the intelligence people, they work on very Machiavellian, cold-blooded, you know, principles, and I don't think that they really have any idealism about how the world works. I think that they're deeply involved in, you know, the dirtiest of dirty wars all over the world, and I think that they in many ways probably revel in that and what have you. But I do agree that, the echelons of the State Department and, you know, maybe even the foreign policy team around Obama and the White House.
To an extent, yes, the
military top brass as well. I agree that to a large extent, they probably do buy into that. But then there is a logical question as to why. Why do they buy into that? And I think the answer is because the people who buy into that are in those positions for a reason. They are promoted to that level. They go through the universities where elements of the deep state are embedded in these very influential professorships in American University and George Washington University and Harvard and Yale and all of these places that produce a lot of these top brass individuals. They go through it. Look, ask anybody who goes through a political science program or an international relations program at some of these top flight schools, they'll tell you what kind of thinking is inculcated and indoctrinated into the students there, who gets promoted through those schools, who makes it to these top levels. I think that the deep state, when we say the deep state, we don't simply mean those elements in government institutions. We mean the elements that are extended into the private sector and the think tanks, the nonprofits, into the universities, into these factories that produce this type of thinking, this sort of post-Cold War triumphalist, democracy-loving, you know, spreading this ideology all over the world. Look, I think you look at people like Samantha Power, you look at people like Susan Rice, people like that who think the way that they do are in those positions precisely because they think that way. If they didn't think that way, if they had a more pragmatic view of the world, if they had a more reasoned and balanced view of the world, let's say even if they had a pre-neocon view of the world, a paleocon view of the world, they wouldn't be in those positions. I think it's very simple, and I think that that's an aspect of the deep state, namely that it promotes that type of an individual, that type of thinking, such that it becomes the dominant ideology. And I think that that's why the State Department is shaped that way. I think that's why those people are there.
Eric, if I could just jump in for 1 second there, I just, for the benefit of our listeners' sake, when we're talking the deep state, we are not talking some wacko Illuminati, New World Order conspiracy. I think you all realize out there by now, we're talking a mode of thinking that is embedded bureaucratically and institutionally in the universities and so on in the United States that does not leave office every 4 years right. with the change of political power. It is not a conspiracy. It is a mode of thinking.
Well, and in some sense, I mean, you know, the term conspiracy is sort of misused, I think, to a large extent now. But I mean, Peter Dale Scott is one of the primary exponents of this term, deep state. And the notion of the deep state, namely, is exactly as Mark mentioned there. It is the apparatus that is beyond the political dividing lines in Washington. It doesn't shift Democrat, Republican, this administration, that administration. It remains in place, and its reach, its let's call it its footprint, extends far beyond the government, far beyond just the private sector, into literally all aspects of the quote-unquote state and non-state apparatus. So like I said, the universities, the think tanks, the press, the NGOs, all of these institutions are deeply embedded or penetrated by what we could call the deep state. And I think that when we're talking about this sort of ideology, democracy, promotion, etc., look at who's the exponent of that. The neocons on the one hand and the neoliberals on the other hand, the Kissingers and the Brzezinskis, although Kissinger maybe ideologically might be somewhat different. But regardless of that, those who follow them, those who follow that model, be it the Bush administration or the Obama administration, ultimately they rest on this principle of democracy promotion, quote unquote. And I think that it is deeply insidious because, as we mentioned at the top of this this segment there, the elements that are actually doing the dirty work on the ground laugh in the face of quote unquote democracy promotion. They understand what the real world is actually like, and they understand the deeply cynical nature of this type of foreign policy. And so while you see on the one hand the U.S. making the same mistake over and over and over again, on the other hand, is that really a mistake?
You know, it's Stephen just in terms
Walt,
of the,
one second. Go ahead. Stephen Walt, who is a professor at JFK's the JFK School of Government at Harvard, writing in the pages of Foreign Policy, as he often does, wrote exactly what Eric is talking about there very well. An article, something along the lines of 10 signs that you are a humanitarian imperialist. And it's a little quiz. I think you know, anyone out there who considers themselves a left liberal should go out there, you know, Google this on Foreign Policy, Stephen Walt, Foreign Policy, Humanitarian Imperialism, and take a look. And basically, he lays it right out. On one side of a coin, you have the face that says neocon. And on the other side of the coin, you have the face that says humanitarian interventionist, humanitarian imperialist, exactly. whatever you want to call it. You know, they're just flip sides of the same coin. Just flip them over. They're interchangeable. And we see this from Newland, you know, Robert Kagan's spouse, Susan Rice, Susan Powers. Within the supposedly liberal Obama administration, you know, we see this clearly carried over. If we get down to the bottom of this, the deep state, in terms of foreign policy, at least, you know, neocon, liberal imperialist, there's the word we're using. It's a deeply to describe the foreign policy agenda of the deep state when we're talking about. What is it? It's a very unfashionable word. You know, it brings to mind the old lefties of the Cold War, but the word is imperialism. And until we come up with a new word,
right.
Use it,
hey.
hegemony. That's what it's
Stop
about.
Imperialism.
Well, in 1956, in 1956, okay, C. Wright Mills spoke about the power elite, which,
yep.
I mean, Peter Dale Scott is essentially, you know, expanding on that theory and, exactly. and perhaps, you know, more putting better resolution to it. But that's that concept is fairly old in academic circles in the United States.
Yeah, and it's funny because C. Wright Mills, one of the most respected writers on these subjects of the ruling class, I guess from a non-Marxist perspective since World War II, if he were writing today and publishing today, he would be considered a conspiracy theorist, a kook, and would be relegated to the lizard-brained Illuminati corners of the internet. You know, right. But C. Wright Mills and Peter Dale Scott and people like that, they have all written about precisely these issues. And Peter Dale Scott, to a large extent, was merely expanding on this. And I don't want to get too theoretical, and I know we're running short on time here, but just very quickly, this was the departure between Peter Dale Scott and Noam Chomsky, who had collaborated for a number of years on the Pentagon Papers, publishing that, a few other things as well during the Vietnam era, both of whom were highly respected and influential. And Peter Dale Scott's difference from Noam Chomsky, and I guess part of the reason why he's lesser known than Noam Chomsky, is because Peter Dale Scott really focused on quote unquote naming the names of the deep state, where Chomsky doesn't really believe that that's important. He considers himself more a quote unquote structuralist who is more interested in the structures of power rather than the individual networks and who's connected to who and what organization is responsible for what. Which is more what Peter Dale Scott was interested into, and I'm giving a very vague definition of this difference, but this is the I think an understanding of both of those two, Scott and Chomsky,
are both really
useful for understanding how the empire functions, how contemporary modern imperialism really works. And part of the reason why both of them have a very hallowed place on my bookshelves is because when you combine the two of those thinkers, and then plus, you know, people like C. Wright Mills and others, you get a more clear understanding of what quote unquote imperialism and the quote unquote ruling class really are. It's not a strictly Marxist understanding of the term ruling class. In the United States especially, it's much more complex than that.
Yeah. I like the word, instead of imperialism, I particularly like the word hegemony, but you know, even I recognize that technically it's not really hegemony, it's more of a suzerainty, but you know, it's a word that plays.
And you know, just one point of distinction, I guess,
that
Mills allowed for the possibility. I mean, he basically said, look, there are people who are in positions of power in the military and in industry and finance and government. Who constitute this power
the press,
elite?
The press, the
media,
NGOs, yeah, don't forget those
two. All of that. but saying that even if it is, as an elite, it isn't necessarily self-aware of itself in toto as an elite, and that's a point of divergence, I guess, between him and say Peter Dale Scott.
Well, and I think that part of the point in that, and I guess I fall somewhere in the middle there, but part of the point of that is that I think that that is a fundamental aspect of modern capitalism, and the modern capitalist or imperialist or empire, however we want to describe it, I think that that is how it functions. Part of it is self-interest. Part of it is people right. just doing what they do, trying to make money, trying to grow themselves, trying to build their brands, what have you, in the press, in the NGOs, etc. But there is a broader system within which they operate, and it is that system that, to you know, pardon the pun, capitalizes on their desire to grow themselves and whatever. So yes, I'm not suggesting that everybody in Fox News has a meeting behind closed doors to describe how they're going to whitewash imperialism. I think that Fox News's function, Fox News and MSNBC and the Washington Post and the New York Times, they function in such a way that they help the empire to do what the empire does. was. And if they didn't, if they were truly oppositional, then they wouldn't be where they are. That's part of the transformation of, I think, the media since, let's say, World War II, and especially since the end of the Cold War. It has ceased to be even remotely oppositional and has essentially become an appendage of the ruling establishment, of the imperial ruling class. And just the same as with the NGOs, the think tanks, the policy institutes, the universities, all of them. And that returns us back to what Mark brought up, I think, very, very well, this deep state apparatus. Whether or not it's conscious of itself is secondary.
Right. Yeah, for the benefit of the audience again, all three of us here comment regularly for Russia Today, for Press TV, for a host of, shall we say, rest of the world media. And we preach against U.S. imperialism, U.S. hegemony, dominance around the world. Do we comment for them because they pay us? No, I wish they did. I would really appreciate
God,
a paycheck.
Someone was paying me. God, I wish they
did. Right? We comment for them. They come to us because they know what our viewpoints and what our opinion are, and that's the editorial line of these institutions. That's the way the Western press works, right. Not behind closed, not so much behind closed, although that happens to a certain extent too,
editorial,
you know, according to Amber Lyons, sure. And yeah, some right. going on. You know, they hire people who share their worldview, who right. share their, you know, this view of the universality and exceptionalism of their society and its right and duty to extend itself and replicate itself around the world.
And on that note, we're going to finish it here. Mark, Eric, thanks a lot. A pleasure as always.
My pleasure, indeed. Thanks, Don.
Looking forward to next time already.
Me too. You've been listening to CPR Sunday with Don DeBar, Eric Dreitzer, and Tony Solo. Thanks for tuning in, and check back again next week right here at CPRMetro.org.